I'm Linda Holmes. I'm here in the studio with Stephen Thompson and Glenn Weldon. Hi, guys.
Hey. Hey, Linda.
So I have some news. Mm-hmm. I got us into a bet with Sam Sanders.
Okay.
So the way the bet's going to work is we're asking people to donate to their local public radio station in support of our show. And I bet Sam that the people supporting our show, that we could raise more money than the people supporting It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders.
So to be clear, you bet against the hugely charming and popular Sam Sanders.
I did.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. We really need to rally. Mm-hmm. We need you guys to bring all your charm to the table. I'm going to bring what charm I have to the table.
So what you are asking is for each of us to muster up 35% of Sam's charm to form 105% and defeat him.
Yes, absolutely. So if you want to help us defeat Sam, and more importantly, if you want to support our show and support public radio and all the stuff that it brings to you, go to donate.npr.org/happy and help us, help yourself, help your local station, help all of public radio.
But mostly beat Sam.
That's but mostly beat Sam, that's right. And here is Pop Culture Happy Hour. Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm here with Glenn Weldon. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
We have a great conversation for people to listen to today between two of our friends, mm-hmm. our friend Sam Sanders, the host of It's Been a Minute, mm-hmm. and our friend Guy Branum.
Yes, who wrote a wonderful book this year called My Life as a Goddess.
Absolutely. And Sam and Guy spoke on stage at the KPCC Crawford Family Forum in Pasadena. This aired on Sam's show. It's Been a Minute. We're able to bring it over now so that our audience can hear it. We will caution you, there is some language that some people might find offensive.
Right. But they also talk about culture. They talk about growing up queer. They talk about some of their favorite children's books. It's a great conversation.
Absolutely. And we are so happy to bring it to you. Here is Sam Sanders speaking to our buddy Guy Branum.
I'm at B. Crawford Family Forum. I've listened to so many events that took place here, and to finally know what this temple of public broadcasting really looks like.
Look at it.
Very exciting.
Look at it. It's amazing. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. Yeah. I mean, yes, Los Angeles is not being hot the way that it normally is, so I am only sweating a normal amount for me, not an extraordinary amount.
I love it. I love it. I am glad that our styles are matching tonight, so I frantically DM'd a guy on Twitter this morning, and I was like, what are you wearing? Because the last
lecture... You said, what are you wearing tonight? If you had just said, what are you wearing? It would have been a different response and a different conversation.
Yes, yes. I said, what are you wearing tonight?
And an evolving friendship.
Yes, totally, totally. All right, so the book, I want to give it its fair due. It is called My Life as a Goddess. It is part memoir, part, how would you describe it?
Well, the title calls it a memoir through popular culture. And one of the things, like, during the course of writing it, I realized that as a gay man, like, there weren't narratives or stories about people like me. Mm. And I didn't necessarily know how to write stories with me at the center of them. When you think about, yes, we have gay people in media, but they are, by and large,
sidekicks.
And it can be, in too many ways, easy for me to think of myself as a sidekick. So I really... when I talk about issues from my life, whether it is, you know, being fat or loving trivia, I look at the way that sort of culture influenced how I see that and how I see myself.
Yeah. Now, there is a reason that the word goddess is in the title. It's because of a story that you liked from Greek mythology. Tell us a story.
Okay. It is a story that I tell my friends with great regularity. When I was, like, in third grade, I found this library book, and it, like, had... a retelling of the story of the birth of Apollo and Artemis, the sun and the moon. And it's basically that their mom had been cursed by Hera because she had messed around with Zeus, who was married to Hera, cursed that she could find no safe place on the planet. In the sea, on the land, nowhere could she find comfort. And she was, like, hot and sweaty one summer day, and she came to, like, a pond, and she, like, knelt down to get some water. And the people there were like, hey, where's your husband? And she, like, didn't respond because she didn't have a husband. And they started making fun of her for being an unwed mother. And then they kicked around in the water and made it muddy so that she couldn't get water. And then she walked away so hot, so pissed off, like, angry at the world for everything. And then she remembered that she was a goddess. And she turned around and she turned all of the people into frogs. and so that's, for me, what the book is about, is, like... It's like, remember...
Frogs, all of you.
But But I mean, these things are of a piece with each other. It is sort of my understanding that remembering that you are powerful. Like in any situation, you do have powers, you do have abilities, there's stuff that you can do to change the game. And it's not gonna fix it all of the time, but also you're not powerless.
What I hear you saying is the hero lies in you?
I guess so. Yeah. The heroine lies in you.
Yes. I want to make you read a little bit of the book in which you are describing this story and how it applies to you and your life. It really was poignant for me, and I liked it, so I'm going to make you read it. I highlighted it and put a star next to it for you.
Okay. Thank you. I am not supposed to be a goddess. I am very fat. I am bald. I have a faggy voice. My family is poor. My parents are uneducated. I dress like a wet three-year-old. As all of you can see now. I am not supposed to like myself, and I'm certainly not supposed to think that I should matter. The world has spent a lot of time telling me that in the past 30 or so years. I often listened, because we all listen. The world is mostly full of fine facts and good lessons, but some of those facts and lessons were built to keep you down. And I got kept down for decades. Then I remembered that I was a goddess. I may not always feel like it, but I have powers. I am an amazing dancer. I'm quite ridiculously smart. I'm strong. I'm funny. Babies like me. I have very strong research skills. I make passingly good Punjabi okra. I have a law degree. I sparkle on panel shows, as you guys can see here. I'm very good at listening when I try. It's not amazing. It's not lightning bolts or control of the sea. I can't turn myself into a swan and have my way with whatever man I like, but it's enough for me.
So fun fact, I did a lot of the reading of your book on the train going from downtown to Culver City, and when I started...
Public transportation in Los Angeles?
Public transportation, bruh.
It's unthinkable.
I do it, but I digress. I'm saying on the train, I'm reading the book, and I get to this part, and I'm on the train just like, I'm a goddess too. And the people next to me are looking over, and I was like, you're a goddess too, man. It was great.
That's lovely.
Oh, yeah. In the book, you talk a lot about the place you are from, Yuba City, outside of Yuba City. But uh-huh. You say it is in no way what you think it's supposed to be.
Yeah, when people think of California, they think of Southern California. They think of, like, surf and bottle blondes and movie stars and that kind of thing. I'm not from there. I'm from Northern California. When you think of Northern California, you think of lesbian sous chefs and vineyards. And that's not where I'm from either. Like, the thing is, everyone here is Californian, so you've all driven up the 5. So you've all seen sort of like the dry, sad middle of California.
And passed through that part on the 5 where it literally smells like manure.
Yeah, I mean...
You know.
This is the price we pay for our lovely meals, okay? California, like, I'm so proud of California and its agricultural production. But also, it's a terrible place to be from, you know.
So then Yuba City was not, it's farm town, but not farm town that you think even.
I mean, yeah, it's not the like fun, upscale, like charming, like vineyard town in Napa where your friend got married. Like, it's just, it's the grapes of wrath 80 years later.
So award winning.
The terrifying thing about my hometown is that like literally, all of the white people came from Arkansas or Oklahoma in like the 30s. So people still have, like young people still have accents. One of my younger cousins, like he was using the word reckon and yonder in California because he spent too much time with my grandma from Arkansas. It's horrible.
I say those words.
You're from Texas. It's allowed.
I know.
We're supposed to breezily talk like newscasters here.
You paint these vivid pictures of your parents who the entire book I was just itching to meet and talk with.
Uh-huh.
Describe your mom and your dad for us.
My mom is an angry older Jewish lady whose family is from Arkansas. So you can imagine the levels of fear and anxiety that go on in that woman. Like, she's always holding her purse as though she may need to flee something. And I get that. But she was also, like, very intellectually and culturally curious. I think she had even though her family were Jews from Arkansas, there was a little bit of a sense of, like, hey, we don't need to be as willfully ignorant as the rest of the people around here. Like, pick up a book.
And she shared stuff with you.
She shared stuff with me all the time.
There's this wonderful scene where you talk about how she, like, snuck you The Graduate.
Yeah, she just, like, walked in with The Graduate and was like, watch this, you'll learn something. when I was, like, 16, and she did so much to sort of make me somebody who would desperately want to move away from her and break her heart. And then my dad...
was, like, the opposite.
My dad was a construction worker who was raised Southern Baptist and sort of didn't question the world of, like, patriarchal, rural, conservative life, and he didn't understand me. And, like, as time has gone on, I've better understood, you don't necessarily want to be the guy on the construction site whose son knows a lot about the Oscars, you know? Mm. Like, that's not really something you can brag about to the other cement masons.
There's that. There's that. But you have this wonderful part of the book where you talk about how with your father and with that dynamic, you felt like you knew that this man could love you and almost hate you at the same time.
I think anyone we have very strong relationships with, we have complex relationships with. And it's a little hard for me. I lost my dad like 2 years ago. And, you know, before I started writing the book, and so it was this question of how do I address my dad in a book that he would have been angry at me for writing? Like, my dad would have been very angry at me for trying to talk about my life in a way that was honest for me. And so the dedication of the book is to my father, Larry Michael Branham, who would have hated this book. I love that I got to write this book, but it feels a little bit unfair that my dad wasn't around to be pissed off at me about it and, like, not talk to me for a year. This should have ruined a Thanksgiving.
Alas.
Yeah.
Come to my house. Time for a quick break. We'll be right back with comedian and writer Guy Branum. You're listening to It's Been a Minute live at the Crawford Family Forum at KPCC in Pasadena. We'll be right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, 23andMe. This holiday season, give your friends and family a DNA kit from 23andMe. They can learn about their genetic ancestry, their traits, and even information about their health. What other gift can do all that? Now through December 25th, get 30% off any kit. Order your DNA kit at 23andMe.com/happyhour. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas has re-engineered socks for ultimate comfort by getting rid of that annoying toe seam, adding arch support, and using some of the world's softest cotton. And for every pair purchased, Bombas donates a pair to someone in need. To date, they've sold and donated over 10 million pairs. To feel the Bombas difference, go to bombas.com/happyhour for 20% off your first order.
We're back with a very special live edition of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders at the Crawford Family Forum here at KPCC in Pasadena. We're here talking with comedian and writer Guy Branum on how he went from small-town California to hosting his own talk show in Hollywood. You write in the book, Yuba City doesn't make sense, but neither do I. How did you not make sense?
As a kid. I was creepily enormous and effeminate, and in this little farm town where I was, like, constantly, I did not care about anything that was in the world around me. I didn't want to know how an automobile worked. I did not want to understand
how... I love that you called it an automobile.
Exactly. No one in Yuba City would call it an automobile. Also, it wasn't an automobile. It was a Ford F-150 that my dad was constantly trying to teach me to fix. Like, I didn't care about dove hunting. I was just desperately trying to figure out, like, you know, who Queen Anne was and what her deal was. People didn't know what to do with me, and I didn't know what to do with myself other than just read.
Yeah, and you read a lot. Which book do you still love the most? Did you still think about the most from reading as a kid?
Oh, as a kid?
Yeah.
From The Mixed-Up Files of Mrs. Baisley Frankweiler. Absolutely.
I've never heard of that book.
Oh. Sam.
Okay, I'll let myself out.
All right, most of your young adult adventures, people are going out. They are going to face a bear or be in the wilderness. From The Mixed-Up Files, Mrs. Baisley Frankweiler is about a sophisticated young lady named Claudia Kincaid from, like, Jersey or Connecticut, and she's mad at her parents for not respecting her enough. So she gets her younger brother to run away with her to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and they live in the Metropolitan Museum
of
Art.
And they collect coins from the fountain to live off of.
Absolutely. And then they solve an art mystery.
I read that book.
Yes, of course. It's amazing.
I'm really proud of your opinion on that.
And like reading that book, I really was just like, oh my God, I want to be that girl. Like, I want to be sophisticated like her. I want to know how New York works.
It doesn't work. When did you feel like you were able to start being that girl?
It is a journey that I am still processing to this day.
Yeah.
It took me a long time. Like, I didn't come out of the closet until I was in law school. Like, I was at Berkeley for 4 long years.
At Berkeley.
San Francisco is right across the bay.
And also, Berkeley is Berkeley. Not even going to San Francisco.
And I still was not comfortable with myself. And then I went to law school in Minnesota because where do you want to be gay? San Francisco or Minneapolis? Actually, Minneapolis is real fun. And so, like, that took me a long time. I think starting stand-up was, like, a really big moment of being able to say, like, my perspective matters. Like, I was so busy being quiet so that I wouldn't, like, anger old men from Arkansas when I was little, that the minute I sort of got out into the world, I just started talking and never shut up. But I also feel like being able to, like, treasure the places and the things that made you while still not being defined by them or constrained by them is like a tension that we're all figuring out. Are you yourself yet? Probably not. You're probably doing like 4 things that your mom demands of you. I have so many toiletries in my home that my mom just gives me. She is constantly giving me deodorant that she bought on sale that I don't need, and it is in my home and I have no space for it. That's me not being that girl.
I love in the book the way you talk about being fat, the way you talk about being gay, because it is not just this simple pat surface kind of body positivity, everything is great, everyone is great. You talk about feeling conflicted about your identities at points, and I want to go through 2 parts of the book in which you do that. When you talk about what it means to sound gay, you've said that you hate your voice and the voice of other gay men, but you also said in the book, we all have to sound faggy so that we can find each other, which I found beautiful.
Yeah.
And I like that you express feelings of identity, not being afraid to have more than one opinion on it.
Behaving as though the constructions that the world presented to us for most of our lives aren't there is just anti-intellectual. We can't behave. We were all alive in 1995, or not all of us, some of us. Let's say we were all alive in 2005. The world was still pretty homophobic then. Like, half of this country still thought gay marriage shouldn't exist and thought gay people were probably gross. And you internalize a lot of that. And I know that when I was young, I had so much fear around people who were presenting gayness, which is really weird because I was presenting gayness even before I was gay. But I also think that, you know, it is beautiful that because we do, like, have the option of visually passing as not gay, you know, the ways that we can be audibly gay are, like, beautiful choices to do something dangerous so that we can find each other and create culture and hopefully, like, quality sex.
Well, and it's, like, the voice, it is portrayed in the culture as a sign of weakness, but actually it's a fine act of bravery.
Right, you know? And there's also just this way that, like, straight dudes are always like, why do they have to talk like that? And, like, I feel like...
Why do they have to talk like that?
Right, exactly. But it's also, like, anytime you say about any group you're not a member of, what do they have to... There is a reason you just haven't learned about it. Like, you just haven't thought about it, you haven't figured it out, you haven't, like, giving people the benefit of just imagining what their lives might be like.
What is the feedback to your voice from people that see you on TV and hear you in podcasts? Like, do you hear from people about your voice?
Well, I mean, the thing is like, I am old and I have been on TV for a while, so it has changed during that time. Like, when I was first on TV on a regular basis on Chelsea Lately, I would always get, like, 2 responses in comments. And they were, they shouldn't have a gay guy like that on. He acts too gay. He sounds too gay. Not all gay guys are like that. Why do they have to have a gay like that? And then it would be, he's too fat. Gay guys aren't fat like that. Why do you have a gay guy who's fat? And that has sort of changed as time has gone on, and we have more representation of queer people in media, and there is less of a sort of like hunger and need to see someone like yourself, and you're able to see somebody who's queer and isn't exactly like you, but still enjoy them and feel a little represented in a way,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. You know, speaking about being fat and talking about that in the book, I'm so glad that you did more than just say the thing that everyone is supposed to say, which is love your body, whatever your body is. I get that, but you gave me more in this discussion in the book, and you talked really thoughtfully about how even when fat people are on screen, it is a representation in service of skinny people. You said, quote, our narratives about conquering fatness aren't about saving fat people. It's about letting thin people feel like they're already saved, members of the chosen people.
Yeah.
That was real smart.
I think that we have a great deal, we moralize weight. We moralize weight so that we have to know that if a person is fat, that they are doing something wrong. And we can watch them be noble on The Biggest Loser or This Is Us and be doing everything that they can to unfat themselves. But if they are still fat, we know that they haven't done that enough. And you guys who aren't fat get to feel like there is something that's kind of good about you. You are doing something a little bit noble by managing to be less fat than me.
Yeah, and that ain't fair.
I mean, is life fair? I also just think that it was important for me to be able to like articulate that, because the world had sort of like sent me a lot of messages about my self-worth and behavior around my fatness. And it was important for me to be able to say like, hey, I don't have to let that into, like, I can push that out of my brain a little bit. I can understand that at the end of the day, there are things in my life that are more important than me being less fat. I don't know what the right best answers for anyone else's bodies are, and I don't know what the right best answers for my body are, but also, this is the size that I've been my entire life. And imagining that there's some magical future where that is not true, and that I should be delaying aspects of my life until that comes true, is ridiculous. Thank you for your claps, but I don't need them. I'll be on TV now. I'll have sex now. I'll do the things that I want to do now. And if somebody else is bothered by the appearance of me, okay, don't watch or have sex with me. There are other people who will.
Mic drop. Have a great night, guys. We did it. I first saw you on the internet when you wrote this really thoughtful essay about the world of comedy in light of Louis C.K. and his dumpster fire trashness. And you talked about how the culture of comedy sets up people like Louis C.K. to do Louis C.K. stuff. And you talked specifically about this idea of the table in the comedy club. I want you to set that up, tell us what the table is, and I want to unpack that essay with you.
So at every comedy club there is a table where like the high-ranking dude comics sit around and, you know, shoot the crap after the show. They stand in the back during the show. Famously, in the opening credits of Louis' show on FX, he would walk past the comics table at the Comedy Store. And when we represent that, we always represent a bunch of dudes.
Straight dudes.
Like when we, you know, have our biggest and greatest comics sit around and talk about what comedy should be, it is always straight dudes. And the fact that this power structure like doesn't have space for women or gay men means that the path up is not built for us as well. That it is a system that is built so guys who look like them can become future thems. And I'm tired of that. And it was, I just realized how much I had spent my comedy career trying to prove to those dudes that I was good enough and funny enough to be taken seriously. And if all of us are constantly trying to do that, it's not going to change anything. And 85% of comics are still going to be straight dudes.
Yeah. Well, and you said so brilliantly, and I had never thought about it this way. You said that sexual harassment is one of the tools that these men, these straight comics, use to remind other comics that your status, that their status is provisional.
Right.
It is a signal. Harassment is a signal of the hierarchy.
And, like, the thing is I am not a person who should be publicly expressing a lot of opinions about the way sexual harassment affects women. I am not a woman. But I think as...
You're a goddess.
which is different. but as we have been so bracingly reminded recently, like, sexual harassment, sexual assault, sexual violence is being used all the time to fill women with fear and marginalization. And just sort of realizing in the wake of all of these things that had been rumors about Louis C.K. being substantiated by the New York Times, that I was part of a business that was doing this to women who were working really hard and trying really hard to be the best comics that they could, it made me mad at myself. Like, it made me so angry that comedy, a thing that I love, was so systemically telling women that they didn't matter. And it was also a reminder that, like, these tools and similar tools are used to remind people like me that we don't matter. Can anyone here name, like, a very famous gay male stand-up comedian? That didn't happen accidentally. Like, it isn't just happenstance. It's not gay guys didn't want to do that. You go to RuPaul's Drag Race, you go to, you know, like, funny novelists, funny writers, there are gay dudes all over the place. Stand-up has made itself a place where people like me aren't welcome. And there are a couple of options in that situation. And God knows, wouldn't I be more noble if I just tried really hard and worked very hard and got half as far? But instead, I whine loudly and write things on the internet.
Love it. Love it.
It's time for a break.
Thank you, Guy Branum. We'll be right back with my guest today, comedian and writer Guy Branum. You're listening to It's Been a Minute, live at the Crawford Family Forum here at KPCC in Pasadena. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities to help ensure a brighter future for America's children. More information is available at aecf.org.
Cube-shaped wombat poop, an elevator to space, and a karate kickin' cockroach. I'm Mindy Thomas of NPR's Wow in the World podcast. And every Monday this December, we bring you all new scientific wows to share with the curious kids in your life. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are talking about comedy, but you've done so much stuff. I want you to, like, rapid fire, tell me all the Hollywood jobs you've had. Go, go, go.
Okay, I had to write jokes for Joan Rivers on Fashion Police. I had to write not jokes for Ashton Kutcher on Punk'd.
Faster, faster, faster.
I had to interview people in a funny way about renewable energy like 2 weeks ago in Las Vegas, and I made too much money for it. I wrote for Billy on the Street. I wrote for The Mindy Project. I wrote for Awkward on MTV. I wrote for another period on Comedy Central. I wrote for a video game show called X-Play, where I had to pretend to know things about video games and sports. And, like, so many other jobs that
Keep going. You were in movies. You were on TV shows. You were on
yes.
Chelsea. You were on... Okay, go, 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 go.
I was recurring on the show Partners on CBS, but the show was canceled before I got to be on. I played Natalie Portman's sassy gay friend in No Strings Attached.
The resident gay on Chelsea Handler?
On Chelsea Lately. I wrote for Chelsea Lately. I wrote for Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell, and I appeared on it. And, like, the thing about...
podcast. Keep going.
Oh, I have a podcast. It's called Pop Rocket. And you should listen to it.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, like, you have to have a lot of hustles to make it through this town. but it's,
I couldn't do it.
It's fun.
You like it?
I mean, it's annoying, and I'm very bad at maintaining a schedule, so I fail at it on a regular basis. As the people who listen to Pop Rocket can attest, sometimes I'm just not there. But, like, there is something nice about getting to do a variety of things. As a non-traditionally looking gay man, a lot of the industry has been like, you're behind the scenes, you just write things. And having a variety of jobs means I get to do a variety of things. Like, as soon as I get annoyed with having to be in makeup, I'm then, you know, at a writer's room. And the minute I'm tired of just being in a writer's room, I'm at the Crawford Family Forum talking to people.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. We're going to go to Q&A, but I first want to bring us back into the book for a little bit.
Okay.
I am going to make you read a bit more about your description of the popular culture of My Best Friend's Wedding and how it speaks to...
Clap for My Best Friend's Wedding.
Clap for it.
That's what you should clap to for.
I wish I had had you watching this movie with me when I was a kid, watching it with my mother, because I would have grown up to be such a more self-aware and better gay had I seen the film the way that you saw it.
But I didn't see it that way when I saw it the first time. The first time I saw it, I was just like, I like this movie. And then I spent the following 20 years trying to understand better why I liked that movie.
Yes, and you lay it out so beautifully. First, I want to give you to give us some plot setup for those who haven't watched it. They're dead to me. But tell us who the characters are and who Rupert Everett's character is.
Okay. My Best Friend's Wedding is about a woman named Jules, who is played by Julia Roberts, who has agreed with this dude who is either Dermot Mulroney or Dylan McDermott. No one knows. if they turn 28 and are unmarried, they're going to get married. And he calls her, and she thinks that he's going to be bringing that up. And even though she doesn't really like this guy, she likes that he likes her. And he announces that he is getting married to this woman named Kimmy, who is played by Cameron Diaz. And that he wants her to come be his best man. And she realizes, like, oh, damn, I'm in love with this guy. I want him to love me. And now I am losing him. So she goes and tries to break up the wedding. It is an anti-rom-com. And she has a sassy gay friend played by Rupert Everett.
Who's there to be her beard, almost, in a way?
Yeah, he shows up to be her beard. But he, like, so magically dances around and on the plot, sort of like reminding all of the straight people that they are ridiculous and there are other ways of life. And I just think it is a profoundly queer story. And the thing, what you straight people don't think about is no one told us what our lives should look like. Like, you know, when we were young, we were constantly being told, like, you shouldn't exist and maybe you should go to jail. So, like, just being able to be past that is pretty nice for me. But still, no one ever said, oh, your gay first date, what does that look like? Oh, do you get married? And we're having to figure that stuff out, which is fun. But also, there is a lack of these structures. And My Best Friend's Wedding doesn't necessarily show us a path, but it craps on your path, which is important.
We're going to do questions now, and we're going to take a few. Raise your hand, mic holder. Hello, thank you.
That was a lovely interview, Guy. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. That's very sweet.
My name is Chris Smith. Who are some of your favorite homosexual male comedians you think we should know about?
Oh, that's a great question. James Adomian, Joel Kim Booster, Solomon Giorgio is amazing.
He's great.
Yeah, both... Solomon, Joel, and Julio Torres all have Comedy Central half hours that just came out that you can watch online. Tim Dillon has a Netflix 15 minutes, I think. I think Mateo Lane has a Netflix 15 minutes. There are really good people out there who are doing amazing stuff, and people are starting to notice now. But, you know, to some extent, the industry wasn't ready for that. Like, a lot more quality was being made than... people, like, these people weren't getting managers or agents a while ago because nobody knew what you do with a gay guy stand-up. And things are better now. Everything's fixed, you guys.
Did it. Nailed it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Also me. You should buy my album, Effable, available wherever comedy albums are sold.
That's right. Amazon.
Yes.
We got another question coming up.
Hi, my name is Shannon Quarter, and this has been so delightful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here.
I agree also about burning down the table, the cis white straight man's table at the comedy club, but how do we do that? Like, do we start our own table until they're like, oh, that's where the cool kids are? Or,
I mean, that's really a lot of what's happening. You know, when I go to New York, where I want to perform, are the rooms in Brooklyn where there is queer, interesting comedy going on. Here in Los Angeles, so much of the really good comedy that's happening are backyard shows in like Glassell Park or Hancock Park. Like, people are creating their own structures and institutions, and I think, like, more power to the people of color and women and queer people who are fighting their way up through the clubs. But I think half of it is just not behaving as those guys, as though those guys are the end all and be all of success, that they are the end all and be all of dignity and respect. Like, be doing this so that your female peers respect you as much as you're doing it for the dude peers, you know?
Yeah. More questions?
Hi, I'm Eileen. So I work with high schoolers, and I read your book at really the first week of school. And it gave me a lot of insight into what was happening internally for a lot of the students that I work with who are LGBT. And it gave me a deep empathy that really changed my perspective on how to work with these students. So if I were to go to them and sort of offer them a version of my best friend's wedding today, for these 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds, what would you suggest that I offer?
Oh, that's a great question. I think two things that spring to mind are the movie Alex Strangelove. It's on Netflix right now, and it is like an honest, like, queer, silly teen comedy that's super funny, but also a lot more honest than something like Love, Simon. And then there was a British show. It was called Beautiful People, and it's about two, like, 14-year-old gay boys just trying to figure out life in the 90s in Britain, and there are musical numbers. And
sign me up.
They do Tracy Ullman's other single. Are we familiar with Tracy Ullman's pop career? Because you know about You Don't Know About Love, but the song Sunglasses, it's pretty great. Yeah, I mean, there is so much more culture that just sort of acknowledges that we have queer teenagers, and I think the hard part is just feeling as though the things that are going on inside of you aren't things that can be expressed and aren't things that are reflected in pop culture at all. At the end of the day, though, they're only going to want to watch weepy things about women. So, I mean, all about Eve. At the end of the day, I mean, all gay culture really can be boiled down to, like, all about Eve, the color purple, and then sex.
The Holy Trinity.
It really is.
Many, many thanks to my guest this evening, comedian and writer Guy Branum. I had so much fun. Thank you, Guy.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to all of you, this lovely, wonderful audience here in person. And also, thanks to our listeners at home. The show is produced every week by Brent Bachman and Anjali Sastry. Our fearless editor is Jordana Hochman. And we can do none of this, live stuff like this, without our senior events manager, Joanna Palowska. Special thanks to everyone here at KPCC that made this show happen tonight. John Cohn, managing producer of KPCC in person. Ashley Alvarado, Tony Federico, Daphne Liu, Quincy Surasmith, and Liz Zimmerman. Our director of programming at NPR is Steve Nelson. And I also want to thank all of the volunteers here tonight at KPCC, Herschel Shivadi, Shelley Scanlon, David Abelson, and Lorraine Moreland. The big boss who signs my paycheck is Anya Grundman. Listeners, we're back in your feeds Friday. Until then, be a goddess. Talk soon.
Woo-hoo!